David Glanter is a well-established and well-known academic, very important in computer science, a working artist of considerable attainment, but also, and from the point of view of this program and its host, most relevant and most important, he is a culture critic, an observer of America, the way it has changed, and questioning whether those changes are desirable or otherwise. He is the author of a number of books. The most recent is titled America Light, L-I-T-E. They market beers that way, as I remember it. Subtitle, How Imperial Academia Dismantled Our Culture and Ushered in the Obamacrats. There's quite a large premise in that subtitle.
There is, and it's probably too big for a subtitle, but anyway.
No, it's a great come-on, and indeed, it's what you deal with in the book. You argue, basically, in this book, and in a wonderful speech that I've heard you give just earlier today, that there is something about intellectual life, at least in the present time, which necessarily drifts far to the left and doesn't merely sustain itself by enjoying quietly the passive pleasures of leftism, but rather constantly wants to remake the culture and all the young entrants into the culture, namely the students who are in the hands of the intellectuals, make them into left ideologues, actively seeking to further transform our culture.
I think that's absolutely true, and it's in a sense structurally inherent in the idea of an intellectual. I think an intellectual, by definition, sets himself apart from society. I think by definition, only a minority, a fairly small minority of the population, is going to be drawn to the life of an intellectual, which is mainly reading, writing, and arguing. Nobody pretends that that's a life for everybody, and intellectuals are more or less happy, proud of their exclusivity. But since, first of all, they'll always be outsiders, minority members, and because they're not doing anything productive in the real world, they'll always be paid a lot less than people perhaps of comparable IQs in other fields. Intellectuals pride themselves on intelligence, and they say, I am smarter, you know, I'm five notches smarter than this guy who now has his own law firm and makes whatever. So both in the sense of being outsiders and in the sense of never, in the nature of things, being destined to be as wealthy as other people of comparable intellectual attainment, well, that makes for discontent. I mean, they're only human beings. It makes them feel themselves opposed, antagonistic, outside, disliked, discriminated against. Some of those are true. I mean, intellectuals are disliked often in the United States. So,
gee, that suggests a very simple solution to the way in which the intellectuals are misleading and really injuring the country, because you feel they are doing so. And that simple solution would be raise the salary to $1 million per assistant professor the day after he gets his PhD and take it from there.
Right. The problem is there are very few assistant professors who are worth $1 million. And I think it is not a small merit of the shift to internet education that it will lead to a free market in education. And those people who are, in fact, productive teachers, that's very different from being an intellectual.
I know that's the one hope you hold out towards the end of this very challenging and really very funny, though at the same time very troubling, book, America Light. Funny because you really pin almost all of the affectations, confusions, and misleading truths, which are in fact lies, by which we increasingly live, especially as they are conveyed to young people in the universities. But let's deal, we'll talk about how America has changed and what intellectuals have done to change America, as you see it, much for the worse. But before that, you make an assertion, and it needs to be tested, that there's something intrinsically left and anti-societal or anti-establishmentarian in the very role of intellectual. Is that really true? I have a lot of friends who are university intellectuals. They're professors. They are, with me and with you, members of the National Association of Scholars, which is a conservative intellectoid organization. Don't people like that and great significant figures in our culture who argue from the right and from tenured chairs in major universities, doesn't that raise questions as to the generalizability of your equation of left with intellectual.
Well, I think there are two separate points here, and they're each significant. I think if you looked at American conservative intellectuals today, who certainly exist at almost every major university, there are a sprinkling of them, and there are major conservative think tanks. My bet is that you would find them in personal terms, in terms of personality, in terms of worldview, in psychological terms, very much different from the standard intellectual, from the left-wing intellectual. It's not just a matter that they chose this politics instead of this other politics. I think you'd find their attitudes across the board to their families, to their children, to their parents, to the country, to the military, to the history, to what they spend their time doing. I think you'd find them grossly atypical of intellectuals.
But was it ever thus?
However, when I say that intellectuals are inherently hostile to the mainstream culture, that doesn't mean necessarily they're leftists, because there have been intellectuals who are hostile from the right. And this was
we've had fascist intellectuals.
Absolutely. The famous treason of the intellectuals discussed in French political and intellectual circles during the late 1920s was a betrayal of the principles of freedom of the Republic in favor of a much more much less secular and a more right-wing view.
A book worth consulting even these days, Julien Benda, The Treason of the La Trahison des Clercs.
Exactly.
The French title.
Right. La Trahison des Clercs is a remarkable book and indicts exactly right-wing intellectuals. And I will never forget, I first saw Victor Klemperer's memoirs. He was an intellectual, left-wing intellectual Jew who survived the Second World War. He was married to a Christian, but it was sheer luck that he survived. It was the firebombing of Dresden that allowed him to escape deportation to a death camp in the end. And his memoirs were from the war years were published something like 10 years ago. And he says in these memoirs, you know, looking back at Germany today, I find it easier to forgive than many of my younger colleagues do. You have to understand how powerful the government was, how what a frightening and immediate threat the Gestapo was, and I find it easy to forgive many government workers. I find it easy to forgive many factory laborers. I find it easy to forgive some of the scientists and some of the engineers. I find it easy to forgive the teachers in the schools. I find it easy to forgive the military officers. But the professors, I would string up every one of them. He says the one group I cannot forgive, who went into it with open eyes, not under compulsion, who went into it wholeheartedly, who didn't just accept but embrace Nazism, were the German intelligentsia and the German professoriate, of course with a few exceptions, but with remarkable unanimity, all things considered.
A metaphor in wide use, I think, since the events back around Jim Jones and the mass suicide that he organized, is drinking the Kool-Aid. What was the Kool-Aid that American intellectuals drank, and when did they drink it?
When did they drink it? I think it was probably the Russian Revolution in 1917. The die was cast. Many leading American intellectuals had East European roots, felt close to events in Russia. Or if they were not, or they might have been WASPs, were at any rate friends of, I think, of Mary McCarthy, whose lovers and boyfriends were often Russian emigres and so forth. From that moment on, there was a tendency to idealize and idolize Marxism. Marxism became the regnant ideology among American intellectuals. And even during the famous Moscow Show trials, even during the famous Hitler-Stalin pact at the end of August 1939 that brought about the invasion of Poland in the Second World War, there was a tendency to forgive anything the Soviet Union did, to insist that they were being unfairly propagandized against. And even after the war, when an enormous amount was learned about the horrific crimes of Stalin, which are absolutely on a level with the crimes of Hitler and of the Japanese militarists during the war, American intellectuals were still mainly Marxists. and we're eager to endorse Marxist teaching and Marxist propaganda.
Were they just drawn to it, or in fact were they drawn in by some secret or at least some very well-planned manipulations? To what degree was the Comintern active in trying to infiltrate and turn intellectual organizations and intellectual institutions in their own direction?
I think the Comintern is much more important than most historians or most Americans are willing to grant or willing to think about. Active Soviet and communist infiltration of the United States, which was most successful in the years after the war, and we know is a dead serious business at the State Department and at many other important government institutions, is something that intellectuals and historians today are mainly just not willing to confront.
Is this an endorsement indirect of the views of Senator McCarthy about, say, the State Department?
Yes, absolutely. The man was a drunkard and a lout. He had no principles. He wrecked people's lives shamelessly and corruptly. But sometimes the truth is not as simple as we would like it to be. And what he said about the Communist Party, its influence in the State Department, in the case of Alger Hiss, in the case of the United States in general in those years, was dead right.
You start your book, it shows up early in the book, America Light, with a quotation from a man who was the dean of the college, I guess, at Yale University back in the 1950s, 1960s. William Devane, isn't that his name?
Yes.
Let's look at that quotation and what you make of it.
Fair enough. I don't have it.
But
right
the general thought.
Sure. The general thought was a brief, unsentimental, but just for that reason, strangely moving accolade to the United States. Not in detail and not boastfully. It was a statement that said, here in the United States, most of our government leaders and our public servants are hardworking, devoted, serious, upright men. Our artists and our literary people are first-rate and are admired all over the world. Our scientists and our engineers, I think the phrase was, are the wonder of the world. Our teachers, our professors and our teachers are hardworking and devoted. I think, again, the adjective was devoted. Just four brief statements about important groups of Americans in terms that nearly everybody at the time would have endorsed in a general way and that simply reflected a nation that was comfortable with itself, comfortable with what it was doing and how it was doing it and with its standing and with its self-respect.
So despite Marxist and communist penetration of some American institutions, and you say it dates way back to essentially the making of the Leninist Revolution and all that followed thereupon, despite that, we remained even in the universities essentially patriotic and given to a serious commitment to some historic values that seem to be related to American history and to the American experience. It didn't go bad instantly. It didn't go bad during the years that McCarthy was exercised over. It only really began to turn, and intellectualism became increasingly in the universities a kind of a variant of a leftist ideology, but also a leftist critique and rejection of just about every aspect of the American experience, you say. And it didn't begin till possibly the 70s or the 80s. Why the lag?
I think it began sooner than that, but it was a gradual process. I think you need to picture two separate parts of American life.
Mm-hmm.
Intellectuals who were mainly Marxists, going back to the 20s, the 30s, their leftist views were known. Their contempt for patriotism, which was a principled contempt, nonetheless was well known. Now, on the other side, you had influential American colleges. You had the Ivy League, you had the Stanford, the University of Chicago, the University of Michigan, the major colleges. Now, going back to the period in which of the 20s, the 30s, of the love affair with the Soviet Union, the intellectuals were not faculty members, by and large.
They were not within the academic world.
They were not within the academic world.
Where were they?
They were freelancers. Many of them were writers. They sold book reviews. They sold news pieces, short pieces, comments. They were editors. They were editors of small journals. They were occasionally teachers in secondary schools. They were not on faculties, except in a few cases. The City University of New York was an exception. There were a few other exceptions.
But why can't we call the people who taught in those days, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, in the major universities, why can't we call them, though they were not leftists, why can't we call them intellectuals? They were surely men and women of intellect who had, in the main, PhDs or equivalent degrees and dealt with, if they're in the social sciences, dealt with the many issues that the social sciences presume, sometimes some grandiosity, to be able to analyze, or they were in the humanities and dealt with all the conventional literary and philosophical and historical materials that are associated with the humanities. There were professors doing all of that, and they wouldn't they ordinarily, is this merely a matter of lexicography, wouldn't they ordinarily be called also intellectuals?
Absolutely not. Most of them were what Thomas Hardy, the English novelist, mm-hmm. denouncing the culture of Oxford and Cambridge, called schoolmasters. A schoolmaster is very different from an intellectual. A schoolmaster sees his job as teaching, as molding the character of the younger generation, of upholding the institutions of the college and the state and the country that he represents. A schoolmaster is very different from an intellectual. A schoolmaster is not a rabble-rouser. A schoolmaster is a lover and endorser of tradition. Intellectuals are very different. I think if you ask the faculty, if you took a survey of the faculty at major American colleges in the 1930s or before the Second World War up until 1941, you would find very, very few describing themselves as intellectuals. They know what the intelligentsia was. The intelligentsia was a fairly new word. They knew what it was, and that was not them. There were some intellectuals. Lionel Trilling got tenure at Columbia during the 1930s. There were some intellectuals, but they were far, far from being a majority, and they were far from positions of power. They were not the ones running the departments. They were not the ones being the deans. They were not the ones running the universities.
But they were learned. They wrote scholarly works, did they not?
The Lionel Trilling, the small number of people who squeezed into the system who did consider themselves intellectual, absolutely. But until the gates were thrown open in the generation after the Second World War, there were too few of them to matter. Just as there are too few conservatives, there are conservatives at Yale today, but there are too few to matter. They don't color the culture of the institution.
A title of another book, not by you, and just as good as your title, that is, in that it delivers in a punchy way the whole thesis of the book in just a few words, and even fewer words than America Light, if you consider the subtitle, is Roger Kimball's book, Tenured Radicals. You know what his hypothesis is. In fact, would you state it?
It is absolutely true that not only did intellectuals become professors, but the institution of tenure, as is practiced at major American universities, cemented them in place permanently. That is, once they reached a certain level of seniority and perhaps distinction in their fields, they were in forever.
And do you agree with Kimball that the mentality, the ideology, the ideational core of that group of new tenured radicals who emerge into the universities by the 70s begin to really get their tenured positions, certainly by the 80s. By the 90s, they're running institutions. They're college presidents and deans and deanlets and so on. Do you agree with him that they were essentially shaped by the anti-Vietnam War protest?
The Vietnam War was an important consideration, but it was mainly important by coincidence because it happened to be a huge controversy involving the United States at a particular time. One has to remember that the bitter anti-American view that was so typical among intellectuals long predates the Vietnam War. The movement, so-called, that is, the group of students and intellectuals that led the demonstrations, not only against the Vietnam War, but in favor of the Black Panthers, in favor of various left-wing causes, trace themselves back to Tom Hayden's so-called Port Huron statement. It was 1962.
That's the beginning of the Students for a Democratic Society.
Exactly. That was 1962. Nobody had heard of Vietnam. I mean, there were Americans in Vietnam in a trivial way. Laos was a more important consideration.
By the way, one of the framers of the Port Huron statement, apart from Hayden, was Richard Flex, who was our faculty colleague at the University of Chicago only a few years later. Indeed, I helped to hire him, not fully knowing just what his history was.
That's
and he's gone
on to
be an exemplar of the far left and remained by now an aged radical.
Absolutely. I mean, these are people, young people, who were bitterly hostile to the United States, not because of Vietnam, but generally because of vague Marxist notions of the sins of the bourgeoisie, which were still a popular term.
Yeah. Did they begin to dominate their disciplines, or at least their departments, and thus their universities? You say they did. How did they achieve domination?
How did they achieve domination? If you are attacking a city, a walled city, you can win in two ways. You can overwhelm the walls, or you can convince the people who live there to open the gates. And think of Henry V and Honfleur and the play by Jean.
Or you can bring in a Trojan horse.
In this case, the gates were open. They were thrown open by the WASP establishment that built Harvard and Yale and Princeton, gave the money, built the buildings, sat on the boards, provided the professors, and provided the students. It was their impulse, beginning in the 1950s, mainly. Beginning with undergraduates, it was their impulse to say prejudice, race prejudice, religious prejudice, ethnic prejudice, we have learned is wrong. We repent what we've done in the past, and we're now looking for excellence, no matter where it comes from.
And let's let the radicals in.
Well, obviously, it was an unintended consequence.
Was it totally unintended?
I think it's fair to say on the part of most of the WASP leaders, the William Devanes of the time, in opening the gates, didn't devote any thought at all to what would be the likely consequences, to what intellectuals were like, to how the institutions would change. They simply said, this is the right thing to do. Morally, this is the right path, and we'll take it for that reason. There are unquestionably among them, a smaller number, but an important influential number, who were themselves leftists and increasingly radicalized.
I can think of a number of my colleagues at the University of Chicago, and probably the same would hold for your colleagues at Yale University, who, listening to this conversation, might at this point say, no, this is a bit of a defamation. It's true, there are some such people on faculties, but there are lots of others. You're confusing mere liberalism with leftism and with anti-Americanism, and that just doesn't really wash. These are perfectly innocent, decent American intellectuals who have strong political convictions or strong social concerns, and it shows up, maybe even shows up in their teaching, though in the main they try not to let their classroom performance be colored by their private ideological or political convictions. But this is not a characterization of total sociology departments, total departments of French or Romance language literature. These are some people, but they are outnumbered by others who are nice people with loyalty to the American tradition and respect for democratic institutions.
Wouldn't it be nice if that were true?
Is it not true?
No, it's totally false in several ways. For one thing, if you look in the classrooms today, you will find most professors make no effort at all to keep politics out of their teaching. They're proudly political, and they see no reason why they shouldn't be. They are actively, aggressively political. This is not something they're ashamed of, something they're proud of. I and my very few conservative colleagues work very hard to keep my own ideology political. It seems to me politics, political ideology doesn't belong in the classroom. I work hard to keep it out. I don't always succeed. But my left-wing colleagues, for the most part, don't work at all because they don't see any objection. They see no reason why they should not. You see, they're not schoolmasters. They're not dealing with the people in the classroom as students. They're dealing with them as adults to be argued with, indoctrinated, not young people, not impressionable young people to whom we owe an obligation, but adults who we should level with.
You would agree with me, at least, would you not, that what you're talking about may well be the case, you argue it is the case, in humanities departments, even more so in social science departments, but surely not in the biological sciences, not in the physical sciences. You don't run into leftist physicists. They may be leftists, but their leftism doesn't get into their discussing issues in cosmology or in particle theory.
Yes, it does, unfortunately. What you say would have been true 25 years ago, even 15 years ago, when it really was true that there was very little political content or bias in teaching in science and technical topics, engineering, medicine, and things like that. That's no longer true. Take two issues in the biological world, a shallow one and a deep one, the man-made global warming and neo-Darwinianism, on the other hand. In both cases, there are official opinions into which students are heavily indoctrinated. Now, the idea that it's not clear whether global warming is occurring, let's say it is, the hypothesis that it is man-made is worth considering as a hypothesis. It's a very long shot. Because we know that climate oscillates. We know that human beings have much less influence at the celestial level than they believe that they do. It is a hypothesis, no more than that. It's a hypothesis worth investigating, but it has become a dogma. It's become a dogma that you are actually forbidden to question in many classrooms. In many classrooms, you would not be safe in the sense of escaping with your grade undamaged and your relations with the professor and your fellow students unharmed. You would not be safe standing up and saying, I think this is nonsense. I reject man-made global warming as a false hypothesis.
You are a professor. I am a professor by now, Professor Emeritus. And we have legitimate interest and concern for the quality of higher education. But the real focus of your book is not merely what the intellectuals or, as I would prefer to call them, the intellectoids, what they've done to higher education, but rather what, through the vehicle of higher education and through other media as well, what they've done to the total culture.
Absolutely. And Yale, Harvard, Stanford have every right to be whatever they want to be. They're private institutions, although they're no longer more than semi-private in these huge amounts of government funding. Be that as it may, let's say they have every right to do what they like. However, we know that their influence is huge, and they know that their influence is huge in many ways. The influence of their alumni is huge. The direct influence that they have over less prestigious colleges is huge. And the influence that their teacher trainees have is probably greatest of all. The institution of the education school, which of course goes back to the early 20th century, become much more important in the post-war years.
So what have all these students of the intellectoid leftists, what have they done to or with the common American culture?
Intellectoid is a very good word, by the way. I'm going to use the word intellectualizer. Intellectoid is a better word. What have they done to the common American culture? They have detached it from America. Their goal is to be global. They don't want to be American. They actively dislike being American. And
so patriotism is an object of scorn, or at least
right.
of
condescension. And institutions like Yale and Harvard and Stanford are absolutely upfront about their desire to be global universities. They are actively opening campuses all over the world. They are actively recruiting students all over the world and sending their own students all over the world. They want to be global, and part of that entails not being American. Certainly not patriotic, and in many cases not even informed.
What have these fellows, both male and female, to be sure, the intellectoids, if you like that term. What have they done to basic American institutions? Foremost among such institutions, considering the health and continuity of the culture, has to be the family. Marriage and family.
This is the most... this is the heart-rending catastrophe at the center of the Cultural Revolution. There is no... we know that it took many millennia to convince men that they had an obligation to marry, settle down, take care of their wives, and rear their children. Men are not naturally monogamous, we know. Men are not naturally drawn to young children, we know. We know there's a problem in this country of single mothers, not of single fathers. It's not all these babies stuck with fathers who can't bear to part with them even though they're not married. These are truths that feminists hate, but cannot hate and deny, but can't alter. It took millennia of culture. It took, in particular, Judaism and Christianity. This was not an element of pagan culture. Women were basically despised in classical Attic Greece. The marriage ceremony was trivial, and concubinage was par for the course. This was an aspect of Judaism and Christianity as they developed. That men had an obligation to take essentially a female view of the family, very very easily destroyed, fragile, easily
some
broken.
40 to 45% of American newborns are born quote out of wedlock, an old fashioned phrase, but I think it's an appropriate one. Do you see this as one of the many consequences of the Cultural Revolution engendered by the class you've been talking about, the left wing intellectuals?
I think it's a direct consequence. We know very well that the percentage of babies born out of wedlock illegitimately before the Cultural Revolution through the 1950s and the early 60s hovered at around 5%. That's not nothing. It's not trivial, but it was stable.
5% for American...
5% among babies, among newborns in a given
year. Yeah, in the Caucasian sector of the population.
Right. Well, integrating across the population, the total came to 5%.
Really?
It was much higher. Because there
was some subpopulation. There was some 30% among American blacks.
Yes, sure.
At the time of the Moynihan Report.
Sure, absolutely so.
It's now, of course, 70 to 80% among American blacks.
Right. But we forget how much progress after 250 years of slavery the black community had made towards the creation of stable homes and families.
Yes.
When you say a third were born out of wedlock, okay, two-thirds were not. And today that would be an amazing and an astonishing fact. This is harm.
And that's a fact which deeply disturbs and constantly occupies the concern of significant black leadership in this country.
Absolutely, because nothing could be clearer if we know one thing from the history of mankind, that a child needs a father. Child needs a father and a mother. This has to do with marriage of homosexuals also. It's got nothing to do with rights of homosexuals or equal rights. It has to do with the fact that we happen to know a child needs a mother, a child needs a father. Isn't always lucky enough to have them, but God knows we have an obligation to do everything we can as a society to provide.
See, there's an incidental angle in terms of culture change. The legitimation of homosexuality as a lifestyle, and now most recently, the turn toward the legitimation of gay marriage, so-called. You see that as in any sense related to the matters we've been discussing?
It is, and it's a painful matter to discuss because, like every person, 100% of people involved in academia and separately in the art world, I have dear friends who are homosexuals.
Sure, so do I.
For whom I would do anything, for whom I have the greatest personal respect. I would never countenance any kind of cruelty or unfairness or discrimination. But the idea that marriage between homosexuals follows from equal rights is simply a logical absurdity. Everybody has a right to marry. Men have a right to marry women. Women have a right to marry men. The right is not... before you get married, we don't ask whether you're a heterosexual or homosexual. Everybody has the same right. But that doesn't mean if your tastes differ from what Judeo-Christian society has insisted on, that you have a right to marry five wives, or you have a right to marry a child, or ten children, although there are many men who would be happy in such arrangements.
Well, you refer yet again to a Judeo-Christian tradition and verity, but an important fact also representative of the kind of cultural revolution that has occurred is the sinking of faith and commitment on the part of the constituencies within those religious traditions. To be sure, there are some which are have a strong hold on their followers or their parishioners, but in the main, certainly at middle class levels and beyond, at educated levels, college educated, there is a decay, not merely a decay of religious faith, but for that matter, an angry rejection of religious faith.
There is an angry rejection of religious faith among atheist scientists in a way that's new, that we'd never seen before. The scientific community had generally was made up of some Jews and Christians, some agnostics, some atheists, but nobody without respect for the religious tradition, just as most religious people respect the scientific tradition. The angry scientific atheist who pretends to cultural superiority and intellectual superiority, who says to believers, you know what, you are basically stupid. You don't see the world as clearly as I do. I'm a scientist and I know.
What's the name of that popularizer of evolutionary theory in England?
Who's done his, Dawkins?
Dawkins. Dawkins has done his book. Christopher Hitchens, that philosopher.
Daniel Dennett.
Dennett. There was a spate of those anti-religious tracts.
Right.
Usually rather colorfully written.
Right.
And bestsellers.
Did enormous damage, I think.
Yeah.
Because the there's a certain innate gentleness in the religious tradition that doesn't exist in the scientific tradition. Scientific tradition encourages aggressive, cutthroat competition. In the interest of science, you want to beat out everybody else. That's
slash
science.
Slash and burn.
Yeah, absolutely. And it would be a great thing. You know, if my lab is working against this other lab, you know, everybody's fired up, and that's the way we want to publish first. We want to win the prizes and be famous, of course. But that same attitude makes you a vicious opponent when you're talking about something of which you are ignorant, and scientists are generally as ignorant or more ignorant of religion as non-scientists are of science.
Every so often I run across, I rethink an old truism, an old saw, and discover that it really is very valuable because it's absolutely untrue. One such is the French saying, the more it changes, the more it is the same thing. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. And I've been arguing recently, no, the proper statement would be, plus ça change, plus ça changera. The more it changes, the more it will go on changing.
Absolutely.
And you feel that terrible cultural changes come upon us. Will it continue to go in that same direction then?
Unless those who disagree make a deliberate effort, not merely to elect their people to Congress, but to change the culture, it will continue. Plus ça changera. We will see more and more. This has momentum. It is self-perpetuating. We'll see the eradication of what we think of as traditional Western culture. The eradication, except in small pockets in the developed countries, of what we think of as traditional Jewish and Christian culture. Doesn't have to happen. There are still many who don't want that to happen, but unless they stand up and be counted, it will happen.
How can they or should they do that?
I think the thing that must be done this instant, this afternoon, is a united conservative and centrist effort to build internet schools, to build an internet school system. Choose fifth grade to start out with, fifth grade and sophomore level of college, and people those levels with courses to which many conservative institutions have contributed. This is a think tank. There are great think tanks in Washington. There are some in New York. There are some in California, conservative think tanks. This is what they should be working on. There are many conservative organizations full of extraordinarily talented and gifted people. They should be working on this problem. They could.
Are you here perhaps sort of indulging your own professional specialty? You are, after all, among other things, a very well established and significant computer scientist, and you're urging more computers upon us.
There's not as much in that as you might think. I mean, I hate computers personally. My wife is the one with the fancy cell phone. I don't have a phone at all. She's the one with a laptop. I do not own a laptop. I don't like computers. and I don't like playing with them. And my success, such as it's been in software, has been exactly because I have no patience for software. I want it to be clear. I want to understand what it does in 30 seconds because that's all I can spare for it. So, no, I would much rather...
But you see, the Internet is a great vehicle coming to our rescue, possibly.
Absolutely. I don't think it's a wonderful vehicle in itself. If I had a choice between a teacher and a computer, I'll choose the teacher 100% of the time. But if I have a teacher spouting nonsense and a computer producing a course that Donald Kagan has helped design, I will reluctantly go with the computer because you can really not never teach a child. You're looking him in the face. But when you get to the point where education, standard education, establishment education is indoctrination and lying, you must choose whatever tool is available. The Internet is a tool, not a wonderful tool, it has a lot of faults, but it is a tool, and we are guilty if we don't pick it up and use it.
It's interesting you mentioned Donald Kagan and Donald Kagan doing a course on television. He has, of course, done that, and it's available. I've enjoyed watching it myself. It's on in his specialty area,
right.
A classical civilization generally, and most particularly the Peloponnesian War. He's a mutual, you know him well. He's
a wonderful man.
Somebody I've known for many years as well. He's a professor at Yale, once the dean of the college. So you're not totally alone at a place like Yale.
Not totally. There's Professor Kagan, who unfortunately is now an emeritus, just as of last term, his last active term. There's my brother, who happens to be in the medical school. You can think of two others, perhaps three, on the entire Yale faculty. So now Yale is a particularly extreme case. There are more at Harvard, and maybe a half dozen, a dozen.
You know, it really is touching for me, that particular characterization, because it activates memories. As you know, I started my academic career at Yale. I was there as an assistant professor until they kicked me out. When I arrived at Yale, PhD hot in hand from the University of Michigan, I ran into the WASP establishment. They were still there.
Sure.
They were the deans. They were the revered older professors. They were the guys who would invite you for a lunch at Maury's,
right.
Things of that sort.
Right.
It had a different old, what was the term? Old blue, old chew tone.
Right.
And I'm talking about the 1950s, I fear.
Right. These were Yale men in the old sense of a Yale man.
No longer there at all.
They're just about totally eradicated. Yeah. I mean, you could point
from
here and there. From the faculty. Not that there are no WASPs, but people who are part of the community, part of the American Protestant going back Puritan community, part of the community that built Yale and has sent students to Yale for many generations and many centuries, things of it in sort of a family sense, I would say there are none.
So the Yale of the late 50s no longer exists.
It has been squashed.
Are there pockets of academic excellence that do exist in the country?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There are outstanding scholars. There are extraordinary scientists.
But I mean total institutions.
Total institutions. There are small teaching colleges, mainly with religious affiliations, mainly in the South, that do a serious and responsible job of education, that don't attempt to be research institutions in the sense of having great scholars, mm-hmm. great scientists. Among the schools that do aspire to be research institutions, I don't know of one that I could. Some are better than others, unquestionably. That is, some allow free thought. Some are more open-minded than others. But there are none that are open-minded. There are none that believe in freedom of speech or freedom of thought, more than half-heartedly.
The last question. I fear time is running out. But this is so compelling and significant an issue that we've been discussing. And let me first once again make clear to all who are listening that the excellent book in which David Gelernter develops these characterizations and these arguments more fully is titled America Light, spelled L-I-T-E, subtitled How Imperial Academia Dismantled Our Culture, paren, and Ushered in the Obamacrats, published by Encounter Books. But before we come to an end. Our conversation necessarily has been pointed at America, at the United States. Yet there are great educational institutions and great cultures which all taken together make up what we call Western civilization. Does all that you've been saying apply just as well, say, in Western Europe, in Canada, in Australia, etc.?
Absolutely, except that after the Second World War, Europe abdicated. Europe no longer regarded itself as a culturally serious entity. Canada and Australia are special cases, and they each have outstanding institutions and don't feel themselves to be post-mortem the way certainly Western Europe does. It's interesting, if you look at lists of the top 10 universities in the world, and there are various institutions that do that. I remember seeing a list in which Stanford was number one, and Yale was six, and MIT was seven, and Princeton was eight or something. They are almost all American schools. I remember one list that rather obnoxiously counted Oxford-Cambridge as a single university. And more recent lists I've seen, both Oxford and Cambridge ranked among the top 10. But those are the only foreign schools, aside from technical institutions, that consistently rate as scholarly and scientific.
But what about the cultural life, or more broadly, the general national life of England, of France, of Spain, of Italy, of the the Low Countries, etc.? Have the same processes engulfed them as you think have engulfed our culture, drawing from our educational institutions?
I wouldn't want to say exactly the same, because intellectuals traditionally peripheral to America were close to the court in Europe. Intellectuals had a different role. They were more encouraged. They had more cultural influence. Voltaire or Rousseau was a culture hero.
Are they then less leftish than our?
I don't know, more so. More or less. So. Their intellectuals, aside from brief flirtations with fascism and with monarchy, but by and large, they have been more consistently socialist, more consistently Marxist, more consistently statist, and which is why European culture is in such abominable, abysmal condition.
We could go on for hours, at least I could, certainly. But truly a last question. Picking up on your subtitle, How imperial academia dismantled our culture, parenthesis, and ushered in the Obamacrats. Explain those last few words.
It seems to me that although Obama was greeted by the entire population with a certain joy that we had passed the tolerance test, and that spoke very well for us as a nation, and we were all proud. But the important thing about Obama is not how special or unusual he is. It is how grossly typical he is of the ignorant, undereducated, over-indoctrinated generation he represents. It's clear that when he was running for president, he made statements about American history so outrageously ignorant, suppressed by the press, claiming his uncle liberated Auschwitz with the American army. If the American army had liberated Poland, the whole Cold War, the whole last 50 years would have been radically different. The whole last 70. He referred to the bomb that dropped on Pearl Harbor, obviously conflating the bomb that dropped on Hiroshima with the many, many hundreds of weapons that were unleashed by the Japanese on Pearl. What kind of man can't remember the distinction between Pearl Harbor and Hiroshima? Doesn't have these clearly separate in his mind, and he said many other things like that. He's ignorant. The man is ignorant. The man doesn't know what he's doing. The man is grossly incompetent. Grossly incompetent. But not atypical. Not unintelligent, clearly. Not inarticulate. Typical. Tragically typical.
But what do the Obamacrats represent in terms of policy, in terms of the history now in the making?
I think they represent memorized leftism instead of leftism from the heart. Certainly, there were radicals, there were leftists, we all know, in previous generations who had stupid ideas, but ones that they believed passionately to be right. And they put their entire moral personalities into advocating and fighting for, and they were willing to suffer for. I think today's leftists think of politics as completely vacuous intellectually. They have memorized their positions. They are unable to defend them because they're indefensible. I think it is a creed past the point of being alive and in the point of corruption and decay.
David Galernter, thank you for an outstanding discussion. And that after you worked quite hard at, and did an outstanding lecture presentation at the Heartland Institute here in Chicago.
Well, thank you. An honor and a pleasure.
And once again, for the last time around, the book that we've been drawing from is America Light, How Imperial Academia Dismantled Our Culture and Ushered in the Obamacrats, the publishers and counterbooks.